Welcome back to Cato's Constitution Day. My name is Walter Olson. I'm a senior fellow at Cato's Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies. And you have made it through the day to the fun panel. Traditionally our most popular, traditionally our most fun, in which you get to hear about the upcoming Supreme Court term and hear from some of the top experts that we could line up. Now, the order in which our three panelists will speak varies slightly from the program that you might have seen, and it's reverse alphabetical order. I'm going to introduce the three of them all at once and then take a seat. You might even hear from me later on about one of the cases that the court will be hearing that I've been involved with for Cato. But we're going to start with Ilya Shapiro. Ilya, for us, will always be the one who got away. He is at the Manhattan Institute, where I spent so long in my career. He is now the Director of Constitutional Studies and a senior fellow. Probably all of you know him for the many years that he spent at the Cato Institute, culminating in succeeding Roger Pilon as being director of Cato's Center for Constitutional Studies. He was publisher of the Cato Supreme Court Review and published 11 volumes of that. He has testified before. Okay, you were responsible one way or another for 11 volumes. And how many amicus briefs have any of you filed before the Supreme Court? I'll bet it's quite a few, but I'll bet it hasn't been more than 500. That is the extraordinary accomplishment and distinction that Ilya has here. He is associated with many other nonprofit institutions, and he is the author of Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations in the Politics of America's Highest Court, out in 2020, and book that continues to do very well. And he's on TV all the time. Now, Amy Mason Saharia is with Williams and Connolly, where she focuses her practice on appellate litigation, including high-stakes appeals in the U.S. Supreme Court. And she has argued in the U.S. Supreme Court, filed dozens of briefs in the Supreme Court and appellate courts nationwide. From 2010 to 2011, Amy Saharia clerked for Justice Sonia Sotomayor on the U.S. Supreme Court. Amy Howe, and I'm going to try not to just use first names a lot this afternoon. Amy Howe is known to a great many of you for her work at SCOTUS Blog, where she served as editor and reporter for many years and continues to contribute articles that I read all the time there. She also argues before the Supreme Court and other tribunals. She served as counsel in over two dozen merits cases at the Supreme Court and argued two cases there. She has co-taught courses in Supreme Court litigation at both Stanford Law School and Harvard Law School. And she holds a law degree from right here in DC, Georgetown University. So Ilya, start us off, please.
Great, thanks very much, Wally. It's wonderful to be back here. I think this is my first time in the building since I left in January, but it'll always have a special place in my heart because I actually got married at Cato and had the reception right here in this room. Trevor, where are you? Is Trevor not in the room right now? Well, he made a joke at his opening remarks about his four volumes that he's now edited, which is great. That means he's done over a third of what I did. So even if his longevity at Cato beats mine, I hope I can still remain the Federer to his Nadal or Djokovic, having won the most Wimbledons and hopefully put out the record for editing the review that Trevor won't reach. And finally, Wally, you missed out. You left out an interesting part of my biography. You know, my recent stint in higher education, and I realized that I had to maintain credibility with this audience. I had to leave Georgetown, and resume a more legitimate position with Manhattan. So anyway, look, last term, as you've heard all day, this is not a case, a term where, you know, I do a lot of Supreme Court reviews, and some years you kind of have to put lipstick on a pig, and try to make sexy some bankruptcy or ERISA or tax cases or something. Didn't have to do that last term. Some on the left especially are concerned that there's a reversal of the Warren Court's civil rights gains of the 60s, but really what we're seeing is a stripping of Warren Burger's gaudy legal wallpaper of the 1970s. These are glasses from last night's Competitive Enterprise Institute gala, always a good time. It had a 70s theme, but really that's, I think, what's going on, and that leads me into the first case that I'm covering, which is the Harvard and UNC affirmative action case. Because if I'm right that the court is really reversing the excesses of the Burger Court, not the Warren Court, well then the next precedent from the 70s in the crosshairs is Bakke versus Regents, which in 1979 established our modern jurisprudence regarding affirmative action, regarding racial preferences in higher education. And this was an unusual case in that four justices said that you cannot use race as a criterion for college admissions. Four justices says, absolutely, you can use race however you like to remedy past wrongs. And one justice, Lewis Powell, the deciding vote, said, well, neither of these is right. I think diversity, but Powell says diversity is a compelling government interest, but race can only be one of many factors to achieve this compelling interest in educational diversity. And so on that one justice's opinion was this whole edifice that has now borne the rotten fruit of DEI bureaucracies was born. And so now, more than 40 years later from Bakke, we have a challenge to the oldest public and oldest private university in the country, Harvard and UNC, using race. How? Well, we don't know. That's part of the problem. There's this black box with a so-called holistic review. But it sure seems like, based on the statistics and based on how much harder it is, depending on your race, to get in at the equivalent level of resume, whether a GPA or SATs or extracurriculars and what have you, and especially among Asian Americans who are the plaintiffs, or at least the theory on which this challenge is brought by an organization called Students for Fair Admissions. And they say that it's, in Harvard, for example, that the intangible score, the personality score of Asian American applicants was downgraded on purpose so that they could be rejected even if they're more qualified than others, et cetera, et cetera. And so the question is, after the Supreme Court in 2003 expanded upon that one vote and had five votes to allow the consideration of race as one among many non-determinative factors, but not strict quotas or other mechanical point systems, will the court overturn that kind of Grutter allowance? And I think it's good that after initially taking up the Harvard case, the court added the UNC case, because all of the previous modern jurisprudence, starting with Bakke and UC Davis, then Grutter and Gratz with Michigan, and then the UT Austin cases, involved public institutions. Now, under current jurisprudence, there is no difference between public institutions and private ones that take federal educational funding under Title VI. And I don't think this case is going to differentiate. This is not about the treatment of, private institutions taking public funds versus the direct constitutional application of the 14th Amendment. But nevertheless, it's a four-square, full-on challenge to the use of race in admissions, and indeed potentially to the idea of educational diversity being a compelling interest that allows the use of race which in other contexts may not be. And this is one area where, if you had to bet, you would think that the Harvard case would end up 6-2 with the new Justice Jackson recused, and the UNC case ending up 6-3. This is not an area where Chief Justice Roberts, who's seen as the most gettable vote for progressives, is squishy. He, after all, was the one who, in a 2007 school busing case, famously wrote, "The way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race." And in his very first term on the court, he said, "It's a sordid business, this divvying us up by race." So still possible that there could be some sort of compromise, middle ground, to pillory Harvard, but salvage the diversity rationale for the racialist shenanigans that we see all across higher education. But depending on what Justices Kavanaugh and Barrett do. But I wouldn't bet on that. The more likely thing is that if they overturn Roe, I think they're equally likely to overturn Bakke. Now, moving from the most important or the highest profile case of the term to the very first case of the term. That first Monday in October, the court takes up Sackett versus EPA. If that rings a bell, it's because there was a Sackett versus EPA 10 years ago. That's how long some of these cases last. This is a property rights / environmental regulation case under the Clean Water Act involving an Idaho couple who's been prohibited from building a home on their property because their lot allegedly contains wetlands that qualify as navigable waters under the Clean Water Act. Now, the problem is the standard for what navigable waters means under the Clean Water Act is unclear, and again, depends on one justice from a fractured Supreme Court opinion in 2006, a case called Rapanos, where Justice Kennedy did his Kennedy-esque thing and waved his hands, and it was good enough for that, but didn't give much guidance to lower courts. 10 years ago, the Supreme Court unanimously agreed that the Sacketts could bring their lawsuit, could challenge certain administrative compliance orders that stopped the construction, stopped the development, subject to fines of $75,000 a day. They could challenge that before the EPA took them to court. Well, for a decade later, they've still been going through the court system over, and it's all stuck on this issue of the definition of navigable water. I won't bore you with the way that the EPA has issued various guidance documents trying to either comply with or sidestep this convoluted test. Presumably, the court will now take the opportunity to adopt the test from the four-justice plurality, which would allow wetlands to be regulated only when they themselves have a continuous surface water connection to regulated water. So if you have a puddle on your property and it rains heavily and has a larger puddle, that would not suffice. You actually have to be navigable water, actually has to be navigable water. That's presumably what is going to happen here. Moving from water to pigs, in 2018, California voters approved Proposition 12, a far-reaching law to prevent animal cruelty, requiring all pork, veal, and eggs in the states to satisfy how the animals were raised, how they were confined, et cetera. California has regulations in lots of industry areas that effectively set the standard nationwide. If you're a car manufacturer, you're not going to have one type of fuel emissions for cars sold in California and another kind for the rest of the country. It sort of sets the standard. This dynamic is particularly egregious for the pork industry, which has very little presence in the state. Only 0.2% of the country's breeding sows are in California. And moreover, the industry is highly integrated and interstate, so you can have cuts that are, pigs raised in Illinois, slaughtered in North Carolina, distributed somewhere else, packaged, all over the place, and you don't know where any given sausage, not just how it's made, but where it's come from, where it comes from. And the problem is, of course, that the Constitution gives Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce, not the states. But Congress doesn't have any sort of regulatory scheme for this kind of that's relevant to this case. And so this raises the issue of the negative or dormant commerce clause, which, trust me, is no sleepy area of law. And it tends to cut across ideological lines. In fact, Justices Thomas and Gorsuch are among the most hostile to claims of the invocation of the negative commerce clause to go against state regulations or extraterritorial applications. With my theme of my 70s glasses, the Dormant Commerce Clause governing standard is this multi-factor balancing test from 1971, the Pike case, which, again, I won't go through. It's, undue burden this, and it's unclear, and that's the problem. So I think whoever wins here, and it's very hard to predict, I do predict firmly that there will be a new, clearer standard for evaluating negative Commerce Clause claims. And so Pike's half-century balancing test, which has allowed plenty of lawyers to bring home the bacon, will be retired and replaced by something perhaps that will be a more clear regulation. And finally, the last case I want to talk about is let's call it Masterpiece Cake Shop Revisited, but without the cake. That is a website designer in Colorado, like Masterpiece Cake Shop was. Remember the cake baker that didn't want to make a custom cake for a same-sex wedding? Was he a free speech martyr or a half-baked bigot? We don't know. The Supreme Court ruled 7-2 that Colorado had displayed anti-religious bias and sort of remanded it and didn't decide any of the pithy issues in what I believe was Justice Kennedy's very last case before he retired. Well, here we have a website designer. So there's no debate over whether there's First Amendment protected expressive activity. This isn't cake baking or floristry. This is website design. And ran afoul, or at least before running afoul, filed a declaratory judgment suit about not wanting to be fined, not wanting to be compelled to create these websites to celebrate same-sex weddings, with which the Lori Smith, the designer, had religious beliefs against. And the Tenth Circuit, curiously, and I think the only example of this kind of reasoning in this type of case, said that the market for any service provider is that particular service provider. That is, Lori Smith here creates a unique custom product. So the market is not, it's irrelevant that there are other website designers available, what their prices are, how close they are, things like that, because every business owner is its own market. It's remarkable, really. I'll tell you, even if Lori Smith loses here, which I think is unlikely, I think this court is likely to rule for her, but if she loses, it will not be on the Tenth Circuit's rationale, which is just bonkers. But to be clear, the court will only hear the case on the issue of whether compelling someone to speak to comply with anti-discrimination law violates the free speech clause. There are some other issues of free exercise or Employment Division versus Smith, which I'm sure some of you know about, but not at issue here. Simply about compelling speech in the context of anti-discrimination laws. Now, the court could slice and dice and find another narrow way to avoid resolving the thorny constitutional questions. But again, I don't think, I think almost certainly it'll be a win for Smith, and it will not be a Tenth Circuit style analysis. So I think I'll end it there. And let me just say that I, for one, am here for a reversal of the Berger court.
Okay. Thank you, Ilya. Now we'll hear from Amy Zaharia.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me. I wish I had some cool props, but I don't, nor do I have any pig puns to offer today. But I do have to offer some thoughts on three cases coming up this term, one blockbuster, one maybe blockbuster, and one probably not blockbuster. Let me start with the blockbuster. That's Moore v. Harper. This is the case in which the Supreme Court is going to tell us whether the independent state legislature theory is just a theory or actually a doctrine of constitutional law. The case involves the Constitutional Elections Clause. That clause provides that the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. The case comes out of North Carolina. The North Carolina Republican-dominated legislature drew the districts for the 2022 federal election. The state Supreme Court, which is dominated by Democrats, then vacated that redrawing as unconstitutional under the state constitution on the grounds that political gerrymandering violates the state constitution. And the Republican legislators who are defending the redistricting say, under the Elections Clause, the legislature has the exclusive authority to regulate the time, place, and manner of federal elections. State courts, you have no authority to interfere with that activity, and the state constitution just has no application when state legislatures are drawing districts or otherwise regulating federal elections. That is the theory. That's the independent state legislature theory. The Supreme Court has never adopted that theory, but it has been floating around for a while. Justice Rehnquist floated this theory, this reading of the Elections Clause back at the time of Bush v. Gore. The petitioners came to the Supreme Court, said, please stay the decision below so that our original districts can be in place for the election. And the Supreme Court denied that request by a 6-3 vote. Justice Alito wrote the dissenting opinion for himself, Justice Gorsuch, and Justice Thomas, saying, this is really important, and I think they're going to win. We're going to adopt this theory. We should stay the decision below. Justice Kavanaugh wrote a concurring opinion saying, this is a really important issue, but it's just too close to the election for us to interfere, and that's why he voted to deny the stay. So no stay, but then the court grants the petition, and so the case is going to be heard in the fall, maybe December. And what's going to happen? Well, I'm not an expert on this doctrine. In fact, I think we have an expert on the doctrine who's speaking after this panel. But I venture to say that if four justices voted to grant the petition, and we know there are four, the four stage, pretty good prediction that they think they have a fifth vote already, that vote likely being Justice Barrett. So I think if you were betting, you would bet we're going to have this doctrine after this term. But it's not totally clear what it's going to look like. There's a very aggressive reading of the doctrine, which would hold that that state courts simply have no authority ever to pass judgment on state regulation of federal elections. State constitution has no role whatsoever to play. There's a kind of a narrower reading that Justice Alito floated in his dissenting opinion at the stay stage, which is when what the legislature is doing is really something that feels like legislating and not just traditional judicial stuff, but in this case, redrawing districts on the ground that they were gerrymandered, that's too much, and that's when this clause has some role to play. So I don't know what it's going to look like, but I think there's a good chance that the court is going to adopt this doctrine and more. So that's the big blockbuster, and it has big consequences for federal elections, not state elections. That this doctrine applies only to federal elections. The second case is Mallory versus Norfolk Southern. This is the court's latest foray into the sexy field of personal jurisdiction. The case involves a plaintiff who is a former employee of Norfolk Southern. Importantly, he lives in Virginia. He claims that Norfolk Southern injured him in Virginia and Ohio, but he brought this suit in Pennsylvania. And that's kind of the crux of the case. Norfolk Southern is not incorporated in Pennsylvania. It's not headquartered in Pennsylvania. So under the kind of traditional personal jurisdiction rules that the Supreme Court has announced in Goodyear and Daimler, Norfolk Southern is not subject to general personal jurisdiction in Pennsylvania. But Pennsylvania has long required corporations to register to do business in the state, and its long-arm statute provides that if you register to do business in the state, you are subject to general personal jurisdiction in the state. So the Pennsylvania courts have construed that to mean you consent. Once you register to do business in Pennsylvania, you consent to jurisdiction in all kinds of cases, whether or not they have any tie to Pennsylvania. The question is whether the Due Process Clause prohibits a state from requiring a corporation to consent to personal jurisdiction to do business in the state. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court said yes, the Due Process Clause does prohibit states from doing that. The Supreme Court has taken a very narrow view of general jurisdiction for corporations in recent years. If they were to rule for the plaintiff in this case, it would essentially undo all of those recent cases and allow states a fairly easy mechanism to unrun those cases hail companies into their states on any kind of claim, whether or not it has any connection to the state. In the wake of those recent Supreme Court cases, and most notably Daimler, this issue really came to the forefront because a bunch of states had this kind of consent principle. And I think at that time, it was quite obvious to me that the Supreme Court would never allow states to do this. It's a little less obvious to me now. I still think that the company will win. But it's not as clear as it once was. This is a different court. Last year in the Ford case, Justice Gorsuch wrote a quite interesting concurring opinion, which was joined by Justice Thomas, kind of calling on the court to reconsider its personal jurisdiction jurisprudence, calling on the court to kind of go back to an originalist view of what personal jurisdiction was before the time of International Shoe, which is the kind of canonical case in this area, and calling into question the fact that seemingly it's harder to sue corporations than individuals and asking whether that makes a lot of sense. So I'm really just curious to see what he is going to do in this case in particular. I still think it's likely that the company will win, but it's not as much of a slam dunk as I think it would have been in the prior court. Third case I'll touch on is United States versus Texas. This is a challenge by Texas and Louisiana to federal policy guidelines prioritizing which undocumented immigrants should be arrested and deported. Since the United States can't deport all 11 million of them, the government promulgated some guidelines. Texas and Louisiana sued in district court in Texas, claiming that these guidelines violate federal law. A different coalition of states led by Arizona filed in Ohio district court. The district court in this case held that Texas and Louisiana have standing to challenge these guidelines and that the guidelines violate federal law. And the Fifth Circuit denied to stay the district court's nationwide injunction. At the same time, the Ohio case reaches up to the Sixth Circuit, and in an opinion by Judge Sutton, the Sixth Circuit went the other way. Judge Sutton held that the states had no standing to challenge these guidelines and also ruled against them on the merits. The Solicitor General went to the court on an emergency basis, said, please lift the district court's injunction in Texas, and the Supreme Court denied that request by a 5-4 decision with no reasoning. Interestingly, the four dissenters were Justice Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson. It was Justice Jackson's first recorded vote on the court. And Justice Barrett was the fourth dissenter, which is not a normal coalition of 5-4. But although the court denied the stay, it construed the motion as a pre-judgment cert petition and granted it, meaning the case went immediately from the district court in Texas to the Supreme Court on the merits and jumped over the Fifth Circuit. There's several issues in the case because we're here to talk about the Constitution. I'll just highlight the constitutional issue, which is whether Texas and Louisiana have standing to challenge these kind of enforcement guidelines. The theory the district court accepted was that the enforcement of these guidelines will result in more undocumented non-citizens kind of out on the streets in Texas and Louisiana, and that will cause them to incur more money and it could lead to more crime. The Solicitor General challenges that in its merits brief before the court, and it kind of offers the court an array of different ways it could hold there's no standing. It could hold that when a state sues a federal government, it needs to allege direct injury and not this kind of indirect injury. It could hold that as a kind of general matter, plaintiffs can't challenge enforcement decisions because those are dependent on decisions of third parties. And it just kind of takes on the district court's reasoning on its own and says this is speculative assumptions about what these enforcement guidelines will lead to. I think Judge Sutton's opinion is quite good and offers the court a pretty good roadmap to hold there's no standing here, and it kind of offers the court some pretty narrow grounds on which it could resolve the case. So whether this turns out to kind of have broader implications or narrower implications, I think remains to be seen.
Thank you, Amy Saria, and we'll hear now from Amy Howe.
Thank you. It's great to be here. And I'm not sure I've ever been on a panel with another Amy before, so this is very exciting.
Another Ilya before.
You have?
I'm going to talk about two cases. One is a blockbuster. One is a little bit less hot, lower profile. And then I'm going to look ahead at the September 28th long conference when the justices will meet to map out new cases for the upcoming term. I'm going to start with a case called Reed versus Getz, which involves the statute of limitations and DNA testing. In 2009, in a case called District Attorney's Office versus Osborne, the Supreme Court held that if an inmate has a right under state law to prove his innocence with new DNA evidence, then those procedures for the testing must be fundamentally fair. 2 years later, in a case called Skinner versus Switzer, the court held that inmates can pursue a federal civil rights claim to obtain DNA testing of crime scene evidence. They said they have to show that the state law has denied them their right to due process. So the question before the court in Reed versus Getz is when the statute of limitations to bring that federal civil rights claim starts to run. Does it run when the state trial court rejects your request for DNA testing, or does it run later after the state court appeals process has run its course? The question comes to the court in the case of a Texas inmate, Rodney Reed, who was convicted and sentenced to death in 1998 for the 1996 rape and murder of Stacy Stites. All of this time, Reed has maintained his innocence. He admits that he was in a relationship with Stites, and he suggests that someone else, perhaps her fiance, who was a police officer, may have ultimately been responsible for her rape and murder. So after his federal post-conviction claims had run their course, he tried to have DNA testing conducted on some items that were found in and around Stites' body and her truck, which she often drove. The state trial court turned him down in 2014. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, which is the highest state court for criminal cases in Texas, turned him down in April of 2017 and then denied rehearing a couple of months later. So Reed went to court in August of 2019, which would have been timely under the 2-year statute of limitations, which is borrowed from Texas law, for 2 years from when the state criminal court denied rehearing, but too late for anything else. So he went to federal trial court, the court threw him out, and the Fifth Circuit ruled that he had brought his civil rights claim too late, that he should have brought it within 2 years of the trial court's denial of his request in 2014. So he came to the Supreme Court asking the justices to weigh in and asking them to adopt the 11th Circuit's ruling, the 11th Circuit's position, which provides that the statute of limitations for DNA testing only begins to run when all of the state court litigation has run its course, including any appeals. And he says that this state criminal court ruling is the authoritative construction of the state's DNA testing laws, and it didn't exist until then. There is, in terms of sort of why this matters, not just to Reed, but to others in the criminal defense community, there's an amicus brief in his case from a police accountability group that is arguing in favor of the more generous interpretation of the statute of limitations. They say that post-conviction claims for DNA testing are often the only remedy available to people convicted as a result of police mistakes. The Texas District Attorney says that the trial court's 2014 order was an authoritative construction of the statute, but at the very least, even if you go further to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, that it was the decision turning him down in April of 2017 that actually interpreted the statute, not the order, the simple order denying rehearing. They also argue that the court has no power to hear the case. Second case I want to discuss is one with which I think many of you will likely be familiar. It's a case called Merrill versus Milligan involving Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which bars election practices that result in a denial or abridgment of the right to vote based on race or color. And so under the statute, you establish a violation of Section 2 by showing that under the totality of the circumstances, that elections are not equally open to participation by minorities. The Supreme Court, in a case called Thornburg versus Jingles, okay, because I listened to it on Oyez, and if it was wrong, I was going to have to blame Warren Berger. So outlined a test for vote dilution. There were three conditions for plaintiffs in Section 2 cases to satisfy before you then move on to look at the totality of the circumstances. And I'm not going to outline all three of them here, but the focus in this case is on the first one, which is whether the minority group can demonstrate that it's sufficiently large and geographically compact to constitute a majority in a single member district. So that this case, Merrill versus Milligan, is a challenge to the state redistricting map for the House of Representatives that Alabama enacted in 2020. Remember that every time we have a census, we need to draw a new map. So Alabama drew a new map for the House of Representatives. Alabama has seven districts. Black residents of Alabama are 27% of the population, and the state drew one majority-minority district. So the challengers went to federal court. They argue that this plan, and this is a voting terminology, packs black voters into one district, district known as District 7, and then cracks the rest of them into multiple districts, diluting their vote. They say that the state could have, should have drawn another majority black district, and that its failure to do so violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. The lower courts agreed with the challengers. They agreed that the new map likely violates the Voting Rights Act. They put the map on hold and ordered the state to draw a new map. So the state went to the Supreme Court this winter, asking them to put the trial, the lower court's order on hold. The Supreme Court, by a vote of 5-4, granted that request, put the order that would have required the new maps on hold, and set the case for oral argument in October. So that means that Alabama went forward in the May 2022 primaries with the new map, will go forward in the November 2022 general elections with the new map. The four justice group in the dissent yielded two separate opinions that staked out different positions on the merits, which give us a good hint as to where this case could be going. Justice Kagan wrote an opinion that was joined by Justices Breyer and Sotomayor, and she said, look, the district court properly applied Section 2 here. I'm not sure why we're putting this case on hold. The Chief Justice John Roberts did not join that opinion. He wrote his own. He too would have put the would not have granted the request to put the district court's order on hold. He would have allowed the elections to go forward, would have required the elections to go forward using new maps. He said, because it's consistent with current voting rights laws. But he said there is uncertainty about what the proper standard is in a vote dilution claim. So I would allow these elections to go forward, but I would also hear oral argument in this dispute over the maps. Justice Brett Kavanaugh filed a concurring opinion, and he said, in addition to the questions surrounding Section 2, I'm also voting to put this order on hold because of a principle with which many of you, I expect, are familiar, known as the Purcell principle, the idea that federal courts should not interfere in state elections too close to the election. Justice Kagan fired back in her dissent. She said it's 4 months until the May 2022 primaries. It's 9 months until the general election. This is not too close to the election. Alabama frames the argument before the Supreme Court as whether or not the Voting Rights Act requires Alabama to intentionally create a second majority black district. And there are a couple of different arguments. One of them, a key question under Section 2, it says, is whether or not the political processes are open to all. And to show that a district is not equally open, plaintiffs would have to show that the districts diverge from race-neutral principles, that from a neutrally drawn map. And then the second one is focused on the jingles factor. It's the first jingles factor, the idea that plaintiffs can show that they can draw a geographically compact map. And they say essentially for the first jingles factor, plaintiffs can't draw their alternative maps by prioritizing race. You need to show that you can draw this second majority-minority district using race-neutral principles. A related constitutional argument that they make is that requiring the state to prioritize race when it's drawing its maps is unconstitutional. The challengers are supported by the Biden administration. They stress that the state is very polarized in its voting, and they say that Alabama's argument would drastically upend the court's cases interpreting Section 2, would have a significant effect on majority representation across the country. They say that by requiring plaintiffs to show that a state's plan is not neutrally drawn, the state is effectively imposing an intent requirement that Congress rejected in 1982. And then talking for just a couple of minutes about some of the cases on the Long Conference. The Long Conference is kind of reporters' worst nightmare these days because there are thousands of petitions that are before the justices. And it used to be that every time the court had a conference, you'd have to try and figure out what the most likely cases were. But these days, in almost all of the other conferences besides the Long Conference, the court has very helpfully adopted a practice of only granting review in cases that they have already considered at least one conference. And there are a couple of these that are repeat players that have actually been around since the summer, since before the court took its summer recess. But one of the really interesting ones that I'm following is a case called Gonzalez versus Google. Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act provides that no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher of or speaker of information provided by another information content provider. Congress passed this law in 1996 after a New York court held an internet service provider liable for defamatory messages on its message board. 2 years ago, in a statement regarding the denial of certiorari, Justice Clarence Thomas suggested that maybe it was time to revisit Section 230. He said the court should consider whether the text of this increasingly important statute aligns with the current state of immunity enjoyed by internet platforms. So the question that the justices have been asked to decide in the Gonzalez case is whether or not Section 230 protects internet platforms when their algorithms actually target users and recommend content. The lawsuit was filed by the father of a woman who was killed in an ISIS attack in a Paris bistro in 2015. And he says that Google assisted and aided ISIS's recruitments by recommending YouTube videos, ISIS videos, to its users through its algorithms. The Ninth Circuit ruled that Section 230 does in fact protect these recommendations as long as the internet service provider is treating all of the content on its website similarly. But it said, we feel like we're bound by another Ninth Circuit case on this topic. And if we were to decide it with a clean slate, we would in fact rule that Section 230 would not protect a provider's content recommendations. I know you talked about the American Hospital Association versus Becerra case already today. There is a trio of cases, all carried over from the previous term involving the Chevron doctrine. One is called Buffington versus McDonough, the case of an Air Force veteran who is seeking disability benefits. The Federal Circuit, which hears veterans' appeals, he says should have applied a presumption in favor of veterans before finding the laws in this case ambiguous. He said, but if you decide that it's ambiguous, you should overrule Chevron. And then there are two cases, Apashian versus Garland and Gun Owners versus Garland, that are challenges to machine gun regulations. They do not ask the court to overrule Chevron directly. The questions in those cases is whether the courts should defer to Chevron when the federal government has affirmatively disavowed Chevron deference, and then whether or not Chevron should apply to statutes like these with criminal law applications. Last term, the Supreme Court in the American Hospital Association case turned down an invitation to overrule Chevron. They essentially ignored it. And so I'm really interested to see what they do with these petitions, either at the petition stage or on the merits. And then we're about to hear a lot about term limits at the Supreme Court, which I'm really looking forward to. There is a Michigan case challenging the constitutionality of term limits for Michigan lawmakers. In a 1992 amendment to the Michigan state constitution, voters enacted two sets of term limits for the state's legislature. For members of the state's House of Representatives, you can serve no more than 3 2-year terms for a total of 6 years. If you're in the Senate, you can serve no more than 2 4-year terms for a total of 8 years. So a group of former state legislators went to the federal court arguing that these term limits violate their First Amendment right to freedom of association and individual expression. The lower courts disagreed with them, and so now it is coming soon to a Supreme Court near us.
Well, thank you to all of our panelists. I'm going to take a couple of minutes to talk about a case that hasn't been mentioned yet, which Cato and I, and for that matter, Ilya, have been involved with, because Ilya was involved back when he was with Cato last fall, and that is Holland versus Burkean on the application of the Indian Child Welfare Act and its constitutionality. And it's a topic that has long troubled the Supreme Court, long interested the Cato Institute for its conflict of rights. The Indian Child Welfare Act, as many of you know, was passed by Congress, which was angry at some of the ways in which state governments had trampled on the rights of parents in Indian tribes, taking away their children without good cause. And it assigns a great deal of power to Indian tribes over questions of child custody. And a lot of that is not terribly controversial, but there are edge cases, particularly involving adoption, in which it has become tremendously controversial. The late Justice Antonin Scalia once said in an interview that a case called Holyfield, an ICWA case, was the most troubling case he had ever had to rule on in his tenure on the court, because the plain meaning of the statute so clearly favored the tribe and its rights, and yet the individuals before him, including not just the infant, but also an Indian couple who wanted the adoption to go through, but could not make it go through because ICWA had taken away their own rights, although they were themselves tribal members, and awarded the rights to their tribe instead. But in that case, Scalia, as he was known to do, upheld the letter of the law at the expense of what he thought was fairness. The issues did not go away, in part because there is this tremendous tension between the general course of Supreme Court rulings on race, which are that government may hardly ever properly take race into account in adjudicating individual rights, and its general course of ruling on Indian law, in which it has said that because of Congress's plenary power over Indian law, that it may always appropriately take into account Indian status. And of course, what makes these in conflict is that largely, though not entirely, eligibility for membership in an Indian tribe is a racial matter. It has to do, in most cases, with blood quantum. That's not the way it works with all tribes, but it is a very typical way in which it works. And so you have had the Supreme Court declaring what are possibly two contradictory things in statutes like ICWA, in which individual rights are made to hinge on not just tribal membership, but in the case of these infants, eligibility for tribal membership, in the case of infants who have never lived in Indian country or in tribal relations, and whose parents may not either. Well, the Supreme Court last dealt with this in 2013 in a case called Adoptive Couple versus Baby Girl, anonymized on both sides of the V. And what they did, you may not be totally surprised to learn, was to duck the constitutional issues using the always handy doctrine of constitutional avoidance, which says that if you can twist yourself into a pretzel to avoid taking on a possible unconstitutionality by interpreting other things just right, it's okay to do that. And Justice Alito, writing for the majority, played kind of fast and loose with some of the statutory language. At least so said Justice Sotomayor in her dissent, and I thought she really had a point, which is that Alito was not taking the most obvious reading of some of the statutory terms, but he was arranging things so as to conjure away the constitutional difficulties by finding a statutory reading that would let the family or the baby, or call it what you will, win. Well, 10 years will have gone by probably by the time the court decides Holland versus Burkean. And some of you have already guessed that one really big thing that has happened in those 10 years is that Justice Neil Gorsuch has joined the court, who has thought about Indian law with a depth that is seldom matched in justices of the modern era, whose rulings in McGirdan and elsewhere have been tremendously influential, and everyone will be, I think, waiting to see how he transforms, because he is likely to transform the court's thinking on Indian law in this area. So That's not the only case that we've heard mentioned that Cato was involved in. In this case, Cato joined a brief filed by the Goldwater Institute of Arizona and the Texas Public Policy Foundation. So with that, I will turn to our panelists and ask if they have any reaction to each other's comments or cases.
One thought occurred to me as Amy was talking about reporters' difficulty with the long conferences. I don't know if you all have considered making a certain pool of your own to divvy up the various cases.
I guess
because you're competing with each other for scoops, I guess it's hard to do.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think it may have sort of inertia. I think probably what happens is that everyone has their own approach, both in terms of what cases they think are likely to be taken and then how you would approach them. But it's an interesting idea.
Well, I think we can all accept that SCOTUS blog is the paper of record for these sorts of things. So petitions to watch, it's where to go.
Sure. As a practitioner, we always want our petition to get on petitions to watch, that's for sure.
Is there an antitrust issue? No, I won't raise that.
I guess, can I ask Ilya a question? I'm just like, if you could play out a little bit more what you think a middle ground in the Harvard and UNC cases might look like.
Well, since Harvard and UNC in a different way, this is one way in which you could potentially see different opinions, is such a black box in how they use race. You could see vacating the lower court opinion for factual development of exactly how Harvard uses race. That would be a way to punt the eventual overruling of Bakke, or at least Grutter, into Justice O'Connor's 25-year end of that shot clock. From Grutter, she said, 25 years from now, we might not be able to justify this extra constitutional deviation. Well, we're 19 years into that. That's perhaps the most obvious way.
Yeah, I mean, the 25-year sunset is really fascinating to me because it was 2003. My daughter was born in 2003, and she's now a sophomore in college. So, I wonder, I don't think there's any such thing as sort of throwaway lines in Supreme Court opinions, but how seriously do you think the justices will take that?
I don't think anybody on either side of the question takes it seriously.
I have one thought, which was just listening to the various presentations that just struck me how many of the cases that we're talking about first came to the court on the emergency docket. Two of the ones that I discussed did, one of Amy's did. And one thing that we started to see last year and that I think continue to see is the court be more creative in how it deals with this deluge of cases coming on the emergency docket. Obviously, it's received a lot of criticism in recent years about how it resolves those cases. And I think we saw it respond to that criticism implicitly last year by taking cases from that docket and moving them to the merits docket on expedited briefing, for instance, with some of the vaccine cases. And now with the case that I talked about involving the challenge to the immigration guidelines, having the court deny the stay, but then take the case basically from the Fifth Circuit and move it up directly. It's another kind of creative way the court might be thinking about dealing with some of these challenges. I think it's a real challenge for the court to deal with this just deluge of cases.
That's an interesting wrinkle, the difference between the emergency and the regular docket. And I think that difference makes its appearance on, some have called it the 333 court now, right? The three Democratic appointed justices, kind of Alito, Gorsuch, and Thomas on the right, and the other three in the center right or middle or something. You don't see that with the main docket. Whether you look statistically, whether you look at the top cases, occasionally Roberts, concurs only in the judgment as in Dobbs, but you don't see a 333. On the emergency docket, you tend to see more of that. Most recently with the Yeshiva case, where Roberts and Kavanaugh joined the liberals to vacate that stay. I don't know, as we kind of go post-COVID, where at least a third or a half of the at least high-profile emergency docket cases came from, I don't know if that tendency or narrative will continue.
I mean, we are hopefully post-COVID, but then I think we're also coming up on election season, mm-hmm. which is another sweet spot for lots of emergency appeals. One of the petitions that I did not have time to talk about in any detail is actually a returnee from the shadow docket. the Biden versus Missouri petition, which about whether or not the Biden administration could impose a vaccine mandate for healthcare workers at federally funded facilities. And the Supreme Court, as Amy said, like, you know, that was one of the complaints about the shadow docket for a long time. And then all of a sudden we saw, oh, actually, they can fast track cases when they feel like it. And they fast tracked the case, heard oral argument in January, issued a decision, a 5-4 decision in favor of the Biden administration relatively quickly. But now that case has gone back to the lower courts and is back up at the Supreme Court in a petition that I think is scheduled for the long conference.
Will we see them fast tracking the appeal of former President Trump's legal troubles in South Florida?
I would say in some form or another, it would be hard to imagine that they wouldn't.
Yep. And I'll add, if you are trying to keep up with the areas where court doctrine is changing, I would put religious liberty in that category, but perhaps election law counts too. It's really frustrating that it is these emergency cases, an emergency docket on COVID cases, where you have to turn because they simply aren't watched as much by the public, and we know the other problems. They aren't argued in as full dress manner, but tracing the development of religious liberty doctrine through the shadow docket cases, you really do see that what a lawyer now has to predict is significantly different than when they last ruled on some of the issues in a full dress case.
And if I can just add one more thing, you know, again, returning to the shadow docket, the Yeshiva case, which was kind of a roller coaster, I think will continue to be a roller coaster, because initially Justice Sotomayor put the lower court's order on hold and then referred it to the full court, and we got some opinions a couple of days later. And apparently today, since I've been here, Yeshiva has announced that it is putting all of its student groups on hold for now.
Wow. Okay. We are not
Of course, with religious liberty, Wally, I don't think any of the panels covered this, but the praying coach case last term, Kennedy versus Bremerton, where Justice Gorsuch in the majority opinion announced, oh, by the way, we'd long ago abandoned the Lemon versus Kurtzman test, another 70s throwback, right? And effectively said all the juice had been squeezed out of the lemon and then we now throw away the rind.
Ooh. Okay. We're going to turn to general questions now, and they will come both from the live audience and from online. Let me say a word about asking a question. If you are one of our online viewers or listeners, you can join the conversation and submit questions on the event webpage or on Facebook, YouTube, or Twitter. Use the hashtag Cato, S-C-O-T-U-S, Cato SCOTUS. And for those of you in person, we will have a traveling microphone. When the microphone comes to you, please speak, of course, clearly and directly into it so we can all hear the question, but also if you could announce your name and affiliation first. So we have, yes, in back there, first question.
Evan Watkins. My question concerning the Google case in Section 230. The way that you phrased the Ninth Circuit's decision, I want to make sure I understood this. So say, however strict Google was being striking down, limiting, censoring videos against American conservatives, if they were not just as strict against, say, the Iranian government, then they would be potentially liable despite 230? Is that the way that it worked out?
The Ninth Circuit in this case held that Google could not be held liable for its recommendations as long as it was treating other recommendations similarly. It said, you know, but if it were up to us without this prior Ninth Circuit precedent, we would hold that Google could be held liable for its recommendations.
Okay, more questions? Sir.
Thank you, Dave Schneer, FME Law. This is for Ilya, known today also as Amy Shapiro. this question has to do with Dormant Commerce Clause. There are two ways I think this could go, and I'm wondering which direction you think it might. It could be that they'll simply get rid of the Pike test and narrow it to what Scalia wanted, which had to do with looking only for instances of discrimination by one state against another, which has long been held the standard that's applicable. The other is to go the way Justice Thomas has talked about it in terms of trying to put it on privileges and immunities and just get rid of dormant commerce clause altogether. I'm wondering if you had some sense of how that would go.
Well, only Thomas and Gorsuch are cheerleaders of the privileges or immunities clause, although I think this is more about privileges and immunities. I think that's less likely. I think the Scalia route is more likely, but I don't know. I mean, there could be, again, this is very hard to predict because it crosses ideological lines. The statutory preemption cases are also hard to analyze and predict. What about if there's evidence of not discrimination but wanting to interfere with interstate commerce? How do you deal with that? Because there is evidence of that in this case. And in fact, the way that California law operates is Golden State agents are sent all around the country to, visit, inspect agricultural facilities. Clear, the intent and purpose and obvious consequence of this law is extraterritorial action, at least. So the only thing I'm confident in predicting is that they will replace Pike with something.
Any other comments?
I'm fascinated to see what the court does in that case. I just think that the justices' policy preferences are so in conflict with what they think about the Dormant Commerce Clause, and we were just subjected to a very strident lecture that we don't read things in the Constitution that are not there, and the Dormant Commerce Clause is not in the Constitution. So I'm just really interested to see how that sorts out.
More questions? Yes, far table there.
Hello, Philip Bohai from AFSA, the American Financial Services Association. I'd like to shift your attention for a moment to the Supreme Court confirmation process. So in the past, we've always had the theater of speeches regarding stare decisis and assertions about the importance of precedents. And I think that in the common understanding in the culture right now, Dobbs has kind of maybe torn the veil away from that to some degree. I'd like to ask your thoughts regarding whether the next few Supreme Court confirmation efforts and processes will have a different set of conversations about precedent, about stare decisis, and about what the candidates may or may not do.
Well, I'll go first since I wrote a book about judicial confirmation battles, now available in an updated paperback edition. So, supreme disorder. So this could go one of two ways, right? Overturning Roe kind of ends, in a certain sense, the distortion that Roe caused, and we've only seen two justices consistent on stare decisis. Justice Thomas always votes to overturn when he thinks something's wrong. Justice Kagan never votes to overturn even when she thinks something's wrong. The others have, every which way. Not saying that they're unprincipled, but just they're not consistent in terms of stare decisis. Will the questions be, more precise? I mean, the candidates know, the nominees know, they can't, predict, they can't, as Justice Ginsburg said, no forecasts, no predictions, no hints. And that's right. You don't want to effectively have judges pre-committing to certain views in order to get confirmed. That's not good. Senators can ask, but the ultimate response won't be the same. So it could be that it becomes less of an issue, and we talk about other things, especially 5 years from now, as the reality that Dobbs is here to stay and. I don't know what if Bakke's overruled this term, I don't know what the next big precedents are that people are going to focus on, but it could indeed, as you say, ripping this veil off could have, the acute political reaction now, but in the medium to long term diffuse at least that aspect of the confirmation battles.
I agree with a lot of that. I mean, I do think that so much of the stare decisis conversation was about Roe and Casey, and that they have been overruled. And, you know, Justice Jackson, I don't know how long we've had Justice Gorsuch, Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Barrett, and then Justice Jackson now since 2017. I don't know when we're going to have the next confirmation hearing. You know, I don't expect to have one anytime soon. And who knows what, as Ilya says, what the next thing is going to be. Is it going to be Obergefell? You know, is it going to be Griswold? I mean, I'm going to push back a little bit on the Ginsburg rule, the no hints, no forecasts. I mean, Justice Ginsburg in her confirmation hearing actually said a fair amount about her views on various positions. I do wonder whether we will see more, as you suggest, more targeted questions from the senators, more follow-up questions. You know, okay, so, you know, this case is settled precedent, but the Supreme Court can overrule settled precedent, you know, sort of playing out a little bit more, or whether everything that has been said can be said on that topic by a nominee has already been said.
Yeah, it's hard for me to see a real change. I mean, the senators can ask more targeted questions, but I think the answers are still going to be the same non-answers, and I don't see that changing.
Yeah, it's hard for me to see senators' characters changing or the interest group pressures on them, which help determine their behavior. Okay, thank you. In front, Ilya Soman.
Ilya Soman, George Mason University. At the risk of contributing to Ilya confusion, I'm gonna ask a question that in the first instance, maybe to the other Ilya, but I'd be interested in anyone else's thoughts on a care to opine. Ilya, you said that in the Harvard and UNC affirmative action case, there could be just an overruling of Grutter, which also have to be an overruling of the Fisher 2 case as well, but there could also be a compromise. I was wondering, do you think it's possible that what they could say is that diversity is still a compelling state interest, at least in the higher education setting, that could justify racial preferences, but we're gonna impose really strict scrutiny on it. We're not gonna defer in any way to the educational judgment of the university. We're gonna require them to actually explain, you know, how you determine which groups are underrepresented and what educational benefits they provide and why Asian Americans are disfavored if they are and so on. But that could be a way that they could strike down the Harvard or the UNC programs or perhaps both, but also not eliminate two precedents. Do you think that's a likely possibility? I think it's more likely that Grutter and Fisher 2 will be overruled, or I suppose there could be some other option besides those two.
I think this is, you get the Amy, that goes to Amy's question about other potential compromises. She's getting the Ilya tag team here. I think that is a possible compromise that they, in effect, I don't know if it's overruling Fisher, but like taking Fisher 1 more seriously, because it did seem like there were teeth in, you know, don't defer to educational administrators and all of that. And then they sort of kind of got too tired by the time Fisher 2 came along and just, you know, let it slide. So Grutter, in effect, elaborated on Bakke and said, you know, you can use race as one of many factors for this diversity interest that Bakke established. And Fisher 1, I think, was supposed to put teeth into that. So it is possible that they don't overrule Grutter, but they say we really do have to scrutinize, which would, I think, entail sending the case back for more fact-finding, or maybe not. Maybe the record is just so overwhelmingly developed and the statistical inferences so strong and the, you know, that they can rule against Harvard without and UNC without overturning Grutter. A more interesting or perhaps nuanced question is, would it be possible to overturn Grutter but not Bakke? And that I have a hard time seeing, just because Grutter got it wrong with one factor among many, non-determinative, but diversity is still compelling. Well, what do you put in its place? I have a hard time seeing that. So I do think there could be some sort of muddled compromise, but if Grutter goes, then I think Bakke goes along with it.
More questions? Yes, Professor Amar.
Akhil Amar. Here's another possible split decision. I'd love to hear all the panelists' thoughts and have the people in this room think about it, because this is an organization that very much respects private choices. Why should the rules for affirmative action be the same for public universities and private? Roger Pelin is shaking and nodding his head. Private universities. Maybe charities must act charitably, and so we shouldn't allow, one could say, this goes back to Bob Jones, that private universities shouldn't be allowed to discriminate against historically underrepresented groups. One could take that position and yet say public universities have to be colorblind, the John Roberts approach, but private charitable organizations should be allowed to take race into account, not just for diversity, but for remedies and all the rest, if they're trying to improve the representation of historically underrepresented groups, given history of exclusion in America. Why shouldn't that be a sensible approach and reinterpret Title VI?
Could I add to that? Excuse me. That's
apparently
exactly
you're going
the position.
To.
That's exactly the position we took in the Army recruiter case. What was? That's right. Yeah, that's exactly the position we took there.
And though I can't quite speak for Cato, I will say that exactly the point being made here has a lot of people at Cato who immediately begin nodding their head, because I see no reason myself why the Harvard case should turn out the same way as the University of North Carolina case. They could turn out completely differently, and that might be the best resolution.
Is the rationale for treating them the same? I actually don't.
There's jurisprudence that says that imputes 14th Amendment standards into the strings attached to Title VI. But they would have to call for further briefing on it, because that issue has not been briefed at all.
Any other comments? Okay. We have time for maybe one more question. I see Professor Adler over at the end there.
Jonathan Adler. So I guess a follow-up on that. If the court was inclined to go in the direction of treating public and private universities differently for purposes of affirmative action, doesn't the court then have to wrestle with the question of statutory stare decisis? Because part of the reason for that equivalence is not a constitutional holding, but a statutory holding as to what the meaning of the Civil Rights Act is. And even though, as a textual matter, one could argue that the court misinterpreted the statute, as a general matter, the court doesn't like to revisit or reconsider prior holdings as to the meaning of statutes.
Correct.
Good point, and that was a fast enough question that if someone else has a lightning round question, we have 3 minutes left. If I don't see any.
I'm just glad you didn't ask about the Clean Water Act, John, because I think I exhausted my knowledge of it in my presentation.
Okay. I don't see any other questions, but let me just say, with 2 minutes left to go, please do not go anywhere, do not rise from your seats. This program will be followed immediately by the annual B. Kenneth Simon Lecture. They will be refreshing the stage for that, but there will not be a general break for coffee or anything. So please stay where you are. Thank you for your attention, and thank you especially to our wonderful panel.